This is a talk on the Great Way. Mahayana means the Great Way. And I'm quite often here, just on reception or chatting to people when they come and visit the centre, and if they've got previous knowledge of Buddhism, one of the questions they very frequently ask is this a Mahayana Buddhist centre or a Theravada Buddhist centre? Are we Theravada or Mahayana Buddhists? And that's quite a difficult question. What would you say? Which are we? Put hands up if you think we're Mahayana Buddhists. Hands up if you think we're Theravada Buddhists. It must be a difficult, because that is mainly don't knows there, I think, isn't it? Yes.
A mixture, perhaps,
yes.
Ecumenical.
Yeah, exactly.
And, well, I tell them, well, the basic meditation practices we do here, mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, metta bhavana, loving-kindness practice, from the Theravada tradition. We teach basic Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, and so on, the Buddha's own life, and the teachings from the Theravada tradition. That's all there. But on the other hand, we sometimes go on about the Bodhisattva ideal. We make use of Mahayana sutras. Here's a little one I'm going to be using later. And we've got, if you look in the other rooms, we've got Tibetan-style paintings on the walls. We've got things around that are inspired by Zen Buddhism, the calligraphy, the Zen calligraphy in here, for example. So, in that case, we must be Mahayana. So it's still a rather difficult question, isn't it? And in fact, the Mahayana accepts the earlier types of Buddhism anyway. So I suppose what usually then the visitor will conclude when I explain that, oh, you must be Mahayana in that case, you must be Mahayana. But I think all this is based on a misunderstanding of what Mahayana means. The Mahayana is not a branch of Buddhism. It's not a school of Buddhism. It's not a Buddhist sect. It's more an attitude. You could say it's a vision, it's an approach to Buddhism. So on these Tuesday evenings, we're going to be looking at some stories, some tales from the Mahayana, some of the teachings from the Mahayana, and I hope that'll give you a sense of what that spirit, that attitude actually is. But I thought I'd try and give you a sense of it tonight, just to introduce the series. And maybe first of all, I'll tell you a Zen story, which gives you a sense of that vision. The Mahayana does self-consciously contrast itself with what it calls the Hinayana. Mahayana means the great way, Hinayana means the little way. And maybe this story will give you a sense of the difference between the great way approach and the little way approach. So imagine, if you will, two 19th century young Japanese monks, Zen monks, who are walking through the countryside. They're wandering, they're itinerant monks, they don't have any settled home. And of course Japan is not like India, it's a bit more like Britain. It's pissing down with rain. Everywhere there's mud. The rivers have overflowed. Everything is swirling in this mud. And I'm going to tell this story as it's told in Paul Repp's little 1939 collection in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And it's become a very well-known story, but I think all the versions go back to this one. So these two monks were called Hara Tanzan and Ekido. And Tanzan and Ekido were travelling together down a muddy road. A heavy rain was still falling. Coming round a bend, they met a lovely girl in a silk kimono with a beautiful sash, who was unable to cross the intersection because of the mud. Yeah. When I think of this, you know, unable to cross, I suspect this is, if you imagine you're wearing, you know, if you know what kimonos are like, and you know how much they cost, and you imagine how difficult it would be to send it to the dry cleaners, especially in the 1850s, I can imagine she is standing there thinking, how am I going to get across this? How am I going to do this? Anyway. "Come on, girl," said Tanzan at once. Lifting her in his arms, he carried her across the mud. Now, Ekido, the other monk, did not speak again until that night. So they carry on their journey, and Tanzan's companion is in total silence the whole time, brooding. When they reached a lodging temple, then Ekido could no longer restrain himself. "We monks must not touch females," he said to Tanzan, "especially not young and lovely ones. It's very dangerous. Why on earth did you break your vows in that way?" And this is Tanzan's very famous reply. "Mm-hmm. I left the girl down by the road. Are you still carrying her?" So Tanzan was actually, I didn't know this, I've known the story for ages, but I didn't know the background to it. Tanzan was actually a very well-known Zen master who died in the 1890s. And in fact, he was the professor of philosophy and of Indian Buddhist studies at Tokyo University, as well as being an ordained Zen monk. And he himself tried to introduce a study of scientific methods into Japan. He wanted to look at Zen practice and other things in terms of empirical methods, actually looking at the evidence for the different practices. He studied medicine. He was very interested in science. He studied Indian languages. He studied Western philosophy. So he was very much a modern Zen master. So I feel quite, in a way, it's quite nice that this very classic koan type story is actually referring to somebody who, well, in fact, was alive only 50 years before the story was published in English form in the West. It's interesting. And he was well known for being quite an iconoclast, especially when it came to the rules. There is another story of him where it says that he was visited by Ekido, his friend, who seems to be a bit of a straight-laced sort of monk, who opens the door to his room and finds him drinking a bottle of wine. "It's about how you can't drink wine. What about your vow of alcohol, you know?" And so Tanzan said, don't you drink wine? And he said, no, I never drink wine. And Tanzan said, "You must be inhuman." And Ekido became rather uptight at this. "What do you mean? What do you mean I'm inhuman?" And Tanzan said, "You must be a Buddha," he said. On another occasion, he knew he was dying, and he called his attendant to him. This is nothing to do with our topic, but I can't resist these empty stories. And he said, "Could you bring me 60 postcards, please?" And he wrote on these postcards, everyone the same, it simply said something like, "I am dying tomorrow. You're welcome to come and visit." He sent them out to 60 of his friends, and he died the next day. So that's Tanzan. So Tanzan typifies the Mahayana approach, or at least in that story of the girl in the kimono, anyway. And his friend typifies the Hinayana approach. The Mahayana is said to be the expansive, the greater approach. In particular, in that story, being helpful and compassionate should always trump literalism, should always trump adherence to the letter of the rules and so on. And in fact, going beyond your own narrow views and your narrow interests to be involved with helping more and more people and gaining deeper and deeper wisdom in order to do that effectively, that is the centre of the Mahayana approach of Mahayana Buddhism. But there's a little problem here, in a way, because the Mahayana is as an approach arises hundreds of years after the time of the Buddha, but yet this is also the approach of the Buddha, isn't it? I mean, That approach is exactly what the Buddha was doing in his own life. Being more and more helpful to more and more people, gaining deeper and deeper wisdom in order to be helpful in effective ways. That's what he was doing, that's what he was teaching. So it's there right at the start of Buddhism. So in that sense, Mahayana is in no way unorthodox. And some people say, oh, well, maybe Buddhism had degenerated. And there is some evidence for this. Maybe people had started getting a bit self-oriented, self-centered. Some Buddhists lived in ways that were forgetting about the compassionate side of the Dharma, of Buddhism. As it became more and more established, some of its followers tended to narrow down what Buddhism was about. In particular, aspiring to personal liberation from suffering, even to the neglect of the needs of others. So this pejorative term, Hinayana, the little way, was applied to that approach when in a way you saw this wonderful thing that you can do to practice, to do your meditation, to improve your own mental states, to reduce your own level of suffering, but without that sense of engagement with the rest of the world, involvement with others. So it's not that some schools were like that and some schools were compassion-based. It's more that some individual Buddhists, and maybe that became a bit of a problem that others saw, and they said, we've got to do a revival here. And fortunately, Buddhism is not fundamentalist, or at least it shouldn't be. So it doesn't say that it was set up in this way by the Buddha and it must never change. So the new teachings that came in, even though I would say they're in the spirit of early Buddhism, there was no, well, at least for a lot of Buddhists, there was no problem about that. They said, oh, good, yeah, that's good. Yes, that's a good re-emphasis. That's a good new emphasis even. So those who are concerned mainly with their own escape from the endless round of the wheel of life, as if they were separate individuals, ignoring the interconnectedness that means that others matter just as much as we do. Those were labelled following the lesser way, the little vehicle. Now, there's quite a nice little classification of approaches to Buddhism by Atisha. And Atisha is not a sneeze. He is a great Buddhist teacher who went to Tibet. He's from India, but he went to Tibet and spent a lot of time establishing some of the main approaches to Buddhism in Tibet, a very, very great teacher. And he suggested that you've got three main aspirations or motivations if you're practicing Buddhism, or even in other circumstances as well. And the first one is that your aspiration is to have a happy and successful life, a happy and successful future, material gain, maybe in even in the next life, but at least if you believe in rebirth, you might be doing it for the next life. But you have a worldly motivation just to be a success, to do well. And maybe for your children as well. You think, well, you know, that would be the most, if I could give my children a good education, if I could make sure they're well set up in life, if I could make sure that I don't have to sell my house to pay for my elderly care and they can have a bit of money, then I'll have felt that I've had a successful life, you know. And if I can retire early and enjoy going to National Trust properties. So that's the worldly motivation. Then the second of the three aspirations or motivations is liberation from suffering and rebirth. That is liberation from negative emotions and attaining a final nirvana as a result. In a way, being freed entirely from the endless round of circular habits, of greed and hatred and delusion. You know, what a wonderful thing, amazing, if you could do that. So complete serenity, complete calm. And this is the lesser way, the little way. And then the third aspiration is the aspiration for full awakening as a Buddha for the sake of all, attaining a non-dual nirvana. In other words, not a nirvana which is seen as an escape, but a nirvana which is not separate from ordinary life, a non-dual nirvana. And that's the Bodhisattva ideal, and that's the great way. So that's Atisha's characterization of these three approaches: worldly success, individual liberation, and the great way of the Bodhisattva ideal. Now, when I look at these, I feel I can recognize all three of them in myself to some extent. and maybe you can as well. It's not really that there are three branches of Buddhism, or even three, you can identify certain people are Hinayana types or worldly types or Mahayana types. Actually, we probably do them all. And there are times, in everybody's life, I guess, where we feel that we have to focus on looking after our own immediate needs, our own concerns. There are other times when we feel we can work on our minds, we can improve our minds and reduce our tendencies to craving and hatred and so on. And then there are times when we feel very connected with others, really caring, and we wish to do what we can to make the world a better place, to be involved with everybody in the quest for liberation, rather than just seeing it as our own personal, separate path. So I don't know if that makes sense. If you've got any questions about this, I'm going to try and make sure we leave plenty of time at the end, so for a little extra discussion, because the Mahayana is such a vast topic that there are many, many things that I won't be able to go into in the talk, but I hope I'll give you at least a sense of it. And that Atisha's three aspirations give you a sense of what the Mahayana is about. So if we look very carefully at our experience, where we notice we have those three aspirations at different times, we may realise, we may conclude, that only the last aspiration is ultimately valid. Because if you really want to find peace and happiness and success for yourself, then you will need to deal with your negative emotions. You can't do it without that. You can't just become rich and be sure that you'll be happy as a result. Because what if you're still filled with craving and hatred? So you do need to deal with your negative emotions. So you can't just have the first ideal, really, without the second, sooner or later. But if you really need to seek liberation from the endless round of habits and so on, then part of that liberation, part of those habits that you need to deal with, is breaking down the barriers and the boundaries that separate you from other people. You can't have selfish nirvana. You cannot have selfish nirvana. It doesn't really exist. So do you see what I mean? So this is what the Mahayanists would say. In the end, the third ideal is everybody's ideal. If you could really look at it closely enough, you'd realise that you can't just have worldly success without working on your mind towards liberation, but you can't really have liberation without working on your tendency to see yourself as separate and non-connected. So what later became called the Mahayana is really this basic Buddhist vision of enlightenment for the sake of all. It's found in the Buddha's teachings, but most of all it's found in the Buddha's life. And this is a very interesting suggestion, that it may be that what happened in the years after the death of the Buddha is that people were so obsessed with memorizing and practicing the verbal teachings that they forgot to see the Buddha's life, the way he lived his life, the way he treated people, as just as important as what he said. And the Mahayana brought the life back in again and said, why don't you live like a Buddha? Not just being an obedient Buddhist and doing your Noble Eightfold Path and so on. Live like a Buddha and treat people as if you were a Buddha, or as if you were trying to become a Buddha at least. So this is known as the Bodhisattva ideal. The Bodhisattva means a person who is intent on enlightenment for the sake of everybody. And if you're intent on enlightenment for the sake of everybody, and if you've got a vast perspective, especially a perspective of many lives, which many Buddhists have, then you might say to yourself that rather than disappearing, escaping into nirvana, I should see it more as gaining as much wisdom and compassion as I possibly can, so I can have a really beneficial influence. Because we can make so many mistakes in our current state because we don't have the perspective, we don't have the experience, we maybe don't care enough. So you build that up, you keep building it up. You don't see any limit to that. You build it up over your whole life, even into future lives. And you say, well, the best thing of all to do would be to bring the Dharma to places where it doesn't exist, which is the function of a Buddha. So rather than just being a disciple of a Buddha, I'm going to aspire one day to actually take the Dharma to new places, which is the most difficult thing you can do, particularly if you see it over many lives, because that would involve you going through your life without a teacher. and moving towards enlightenment, hoping you had enough momentum from previous lives to take you to enlightenment, as the Buddha did, without a teacher. Because he did, you know, the reason he's so revered is not because his enlightenment was a higher level than that of his disciples, but because he did it without help. And so, that's what's needed. If the Dharma dies out, or if it doesn't exist in a particular place, then you need people who can practice it without help, you know, which is a big ask. So the suggestion from the Mahayana was that this requires a lot of preparation, a lot of building up to that level where you can do that. So it has been said that this Bodhisattva ideal is the most sublime vision of human potential that has ever been described. And it might be interesting to think, can you think of any others that are quite as grand as that? Maybe you might say quite as fantastic, even quite as ridiculous as that. What a thought, the idea that you come back life after life after life with the idea of being there when Buddhism has completely died out, to revive it from scratch. You know, it's a very grandiose idea, isn't it? You could even say a very egotistical idea if it wasn't supposed to be the opposite of egotism. But perhaps, yes, the most sublime ideal that's ever been thought of, because it has no limits at all, because it's an infinite ideal, it's vast in scope. So you're striving for life after life to perfect yourself and striving to aid others in all those three ways. You're trying to help people to become more comfortable and wealthy and successful, but you're also trying to help them to liberate themselves from negative emotions, and you're also trying to help them to join that great stream where you create circumstances where everybody can successfully practice, which is called building the pure land in the Mahayana. Now, the individual practice of the Bodhisattva is described in the Six Perfections. And this is if we could even easily have a whole series on the perfections. But just to remind you, if you haven't come across them, the Bodhisattva needs first of all to practice giving. You see why this comes first? Because you've got to start to get beyond that sense of your own personal needs. So can I be generous? Even just generous in just very ordinary ways. Just helping someone put out the rubbish or something, but just giving. Then the second one, leading an upright life. The third one is forbearance in difficult circumstances and with difficult people. Developing forbearance, a very, very hard practice. And then the fourth one is energy. Energy in transforming the mind, energy in working for others' benefit. And then the fifth one is profound meditation. And finally, the perfection which makes all the other practices perfect, which is the perfection of wisdom. And the perfection of wisdom, again, is a very important strand in the Mahayana, trying to express the inexpressible in all sorts of ways. So I want to go back to see how this all started. And it's one of the biggest mysteries in Buddhism, actually. Nobody knows how the Mahayana started. And the more they look into it, the more scholars look into it, the more they discover that what other people have assumed or guessed at is probably wrong. But the trouble is, the years after the time of the Buddha, particularly after the time of Ashoka, where we do have some records, are a very misty period. It's very difficult to know what was going on there. There are ways of studying it, and it is being studied, and no doubt new conclusions will come. But it looks as if, first of all, not long after the Buddha died, a number of separate different Buddhist traditions emerged with different emphases. And some of these were already stressing the Bodhisattva ideal, because the Bodhisattva ideal is explicitly present in the very earliest strata of Buddhism. In early Buddhism, first of all, the Bodhisattva is a description of the Buddha, what the Buddha was like before his enlightenment. A Bodhisattva is somebody who's moving towards enlightenment. Well, that was what the Buddha was doing before he gained enlightenment, and even in previous lives as well. A being striving for the enlightenment for the sake of everybody. And we also meet another Bodhisattva. We only meet two Bodhisattvas in the early texts. We meet the Buddha before he gained enlightenment, and we also meet somebody who we've already met this evening. Can anyone guess who that is?
Maitreya.
Maitreya, that's right. So in the very early texts, you have Maitreya. It discusses these predictions. It says, even the Buddha himself says, look, Buddhism is going to die out one day. When it dies out, it's going to need another Buddha. His name's going to be Maitreya, the loving one. And there's some little details about him in there. And so those are the two bodhisattvas that turn up. But they are there. And it is there, it's seen as an aspiration that anybody can have to try to do that. But it's seen as a bit of a minority one in those early texts. Some of the early traditions also started to see the Buddha in a new way, not just as the human founder of Buddhism, but also as a sort of a transcendental principle. The Buddha becomes the potential for enlightenment inherent in all conscious creatures. And this principle is symbolized by the cosmic Buddhas presiding over whole galaxies of worlds, you know, amazing descriptions of the great red Buddha of the West, the great blue Buddha of the East, and so on. And they've got their names, they've got their worlds, they've got their teachings, they've got their lives, their actions. So that's the second thing that started to come up in some of those early schools of Buddhism, was the Buddha as a cosmic principle, not just a human founder of Buddhism. The potential within as well, the Buddha nature, the potential that everybody has within for enlightenment, as if it's already there and just needs an uncovering. And also in early Buddhism, you'll come across the teaching of emptiness or shunyata. You remember on this calligraphy, form is only emptiness. Emptiness is only form, from the Mahayana Heart Sutra. And this is the sense that words can never really capture the reality of human experience, and all concepts or labels that we use must be taken as being maybe helpful, but just provisional. They're not ultimately true. Whatever you say won't be ultimately true, because it's applying concepts to something that can't be tied down, that is the flow of human experience. And related to that is the idea of skillful means. So as well as the words, the rules and the teachings that you've adopted are also not to be taken literally. Always the priority is the welfare of others. Even if you, you know, despite your best intentions, you have to pick up a beautiful young girl wearing a kimono and carry her across the mud in breach of all your celibacy vows as a monk. So that would be skillful means, a basic Mahayana principle. So as some forms of Buddhism become too formalistic, all the strands that, you know, were proto-Mahayana, the idea of the Bodhisattva ideal, the cosmic Buddha, skillful means, shunyata, and so on, many of these strands, they seem to have come together. And this is the mystery, but they seem to have come together amongst a number of very serious meditators living in the Indian jungles, away from the big monasteries, where they were just doing very intensive practice. As they practiced, they were having visions. In their visions, they saw and met cosmic Buddhas. And the cosmic Buddhas taught them. And they wrote down what they taught. And what they wrote down became the Mahayana Sutras, a new strand of teachings in Buddhism that doesn't go back to the time of the Buddha, but is regarded as coming from the cosmic Buddha instead. And so from a more fundamentalist point of view, a more literalist point of view, people say they're forgeries. They're not really Buddhist sutras. Sutras are supposed to come back from the personal Buddha himself. But from the Mahayana point of view, that's not a problem. They say, no, it's all right. They come from the cosmic Buddha. So in this series, on Tuesday evenings, we're going to hear teachings from some of these texts. We're going to hear teachings from the Lotus Sutra, maybe the most famous of them all. Maybe also from the Sutras of Perfect Wisdom. From the Vimalakirti Sutra, Stainless Glory. And later tonight, I'll tell you a story from this one, which is called the Avatamsaka, the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flower ornament. So just to summarise, the Mahayana has got a universal perspective. That's the term that Lama Govinda, a great German Buddhist of the 20th century, uses. He says it's this universal perspective. Its scope is all beings, its aim is full Buddhahood, and its frame of reference is infinite space and time. So it is all pretty cosmic and pretty vast. And therefore, you know, the downside of that is it can become mere fantasy. So although it can be very inspiring and really open your imagination, it can also become a little bit distant from you and become just a little bit as if you're watching CGI all the time. At the back of your mind, you know, this is just CGI, isn't it? You know, Amitabha Buddha, come on, you know, get him. But actually, if you really can take it on, you'll find that it can transform the way you see the world, if it's not just a fantasy. But that's the danger with it. And part of that fantasy, by the way, is if you take it too literally, which is what the Mahayana warns against, and you see yourself as progressing through millions of lifetimes, becoming more and more wonderful until you become a Buddha, that can just feed the ego. And in fact, it can prevent the very process from happening at all. And it's better to see that process as not being a personal, individual thing, but as being a great trend, a great stream of compassion, of altruism, running through, involving many people, and not being my vow to gain Buddhahood. Do you see what I mean? We can discuss that. So the reason that people come inquiring here about whether we are Mahayana or Theravada is because Westerners have developed the idea that Buddhism is divided into Southern Buddhism and Northern Buddhism, and they've developed the idea that the Northern Buddhist countries are Mahayana countries. That is Tibet, Mongolia, China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and so on. Some of those countries are said to be Mahayana countries. And the ones of so-called Southern Buddhism, such as Sri Lanka, Thailand, Myanmar, and so on, those are not Mahayana. And so from the Mahayana point of view, if you are a Mahayanist, they are Hinayana. They must be lesser vehicle, or little way. Now, this isn't completely wrong, because it is indeed in those so-called Northern Buddhist countries that the Mahayana sutras and the Mahayana teachings, as they developed in later Buddhist India, it's there that they are accepted, while in general they're not so accepted in the Southern countries. But it really isn't like that. It's not really the best way to understand Mahayana, I think. I had a friend who lived in a Buddhist monastery near Newcastle. Harnham is called, Harnham Monastery. And this is a Theravadin monastery. And I visited him there, and I met up with a guy called Munindo. And Munindo is the abbot of that monastery, a New Zealand Theravadin monk. And he showed me the shrine room. And to my surprise, in an honoured position there in the shrine room, was a beautiful wooden carved statue of Kuan Yin. Now, Kuan Yin is the Chinese female form of Avalokiteshvara, the Mahayana Bodhisattva of compassion. And then in his office as well, there was a lovely painting of Kuan Yin on the wall. So I asked him about this, because I was a bit surprised. He said, oh yeah, he said he felt that in the monastery, the problem was that there weren't any really positive female archetypes. You had the Buddha, you had the statues of the monks and things, but he felt there was something serious missing there. And he felt perfectly happy to draw on that Mahayana figure, the Mahayana being much more inclusive when it comes to gender as well. And he said, yeah, I feel that really adds something to what we're doing here in this Theravadin monastery. And then another visit I made, I went to give some lectures in Singapore a long time ago, and I stayed there in the Buddhist library, as it was called, a Buddhist centre called the Buddhist Library, run by a Sri Lankan Theravada monk. And the Theravadins, as an aside, they were often the Buddhists most likely to go to places where there was a need for Buddhist teachings. You go to Singapore, you go to Malaysia, you go to India, and you'll often find it's Theravadin monks, so-called little vehicle, so-called not compassionate. They're the ones who are really going out there to teach Buddhism. While, you know, I don't want to be too critical, but the Tibetans, until the Chinese came along, and so they all became refugees, many of the great lamas, until then they were happy to stay in Tibet, maybe just to go over into China and Mongolia a bit, but it wasn't until they were forced to leave that they came to the West. So it's interesting, isn't it? So-called Mahayana country, so-called Hinayana country. So they're there in Singapore. They were ethnic Chinese Buddhists, which means Mahayana Buddhists, but they were very happy to be taught by a Theravadin monk. And in the Buddhist library, he was happy to include the whole range of Buddhist teachings there. It was all in there. So I hope that here, in this centre, there is very much the spirit of the Bodhisattva ideal. I really hope that can be there. It's a difficult thing to achieve, and one mustn't sort of pretend, but an ideal that's really accepted by all Buddhists, the Bodhisattva ideal, and developed in very beautiful ways in the later Buddhist movements that call themselves Mahayana. So I hope that gives you a sense of the Mahayana. The Mahayana is a spirit, it's an aspiration, it's something vast, it's something big. That's why it's called the Great Way. It's great in that it's supposed to appeal to everybody, whatever, whether you're a monk or a lay person, whether you're a man or a woman, whether a Buddhist or not, even. It's supposed to be something that is basically interested in helping, in making a positive difference to people's lives. That's the idea. And it accepts these newish, or at least ideas that you don't find so strongly in Theravada Buddhism, things like the idea of the cosmic Buddha, the idea of the vast scope of the Bodhisattva ideal, the pure lands, skillful means, and so on. So I'm not going to say any more theoretically about Mahayana. You can ask questions at the end if you want to, but I do want to finish with another, well, I was going to say story. There's not much that happens in this, actually. It's more a vision. And maybe this is the kind of thing that happened to those Buddhists living in the jungles, spending so much time meditating, so that they started to meet the cosmic Buddhas and the cosmic Bodhisattvas. And this is from the Avatamsaka Sutra. This is actually the most splendid and longest of all the Mahayana Sutras, at least in English translation. There may be some yet, there are many Mahayana Sutras that haven't yet been translated. And maybe there's an even fatter one than this. But it runs to over 1,500 pages. I took it away with me on my solitary retreat over Christmas to try to get... And I've done that before, actually. I'm sort of gradually over the years trying to get used to the sutra. Now I'd like to give you a flavour of the vast imagination, the limitless vision of a Mahayana sutra. And I'm going to actually quote something from this one, read it out. Now the culmination of this sutra, after many, many other things going on, is a quest, a pilgrimage, a Buddhist pilgrimage by a young man called Suddhana, a young bodhisattva called Suddhana. It doesn't even bother to say if he's a monk or not. He's just a Buddhist. He's a bodhisattva in the sense that he aspires to achieve liberation for the sake of all. But he doesn't know how to do it. And so he goes to a teacher. And the teacher he finds, fortunately for him, is called Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom. But this is only the first of 52 teachers. And the sutra consists of 52 sections describing all the different extraordinary teachings given to him by each person he meets. So he meets Manjushri, and Manjushri says, okay, that's enough for now. I now want you to go and see so-and-so, and they'll give you some new teachings. And sometimes he has to make a huge journey, and he goes there and finds them, and they're busy, and he has to hang around. But eventually, he gets the teachings from them. And they're all sorts of people. They're monks, and they're lay people. They're men and women. Even some of them are children. They are celestial beings, even dragons, some of them. So he meets all these amazing teachers. Several of them are goddesses who live in the Bodhi tree, where the Buddha gained enlightenment, which is quite nice, isn't it? Anyway, those are the people that he meets, 52 of them. They're all known as spiritual friends. This is the term that's used, Kalyana Mitra, spiritual friends. They are his mates, his friends, but they're offering him the Dharma as their gift of friendship. And they've all got their own different experience of Buddhist practice. They've got all sorts of professions, all sorts of histories. And at the very end, number 51, he meets two, a boy and a girl, two children. And these symbolise freshness, because of their youth, but also completeness, because it's male and female. And they send him to his final teacher, number 52. And his final teacher, we have met before. It is Maitreya, the next Buddha. But here a bodhisattva, the teacher of love, Maitri, or metta, being love. And Maitreya, in the sutra, is the guardian of a tower. He's the guardian of Virochana's tower, or the tower of the adornments of Virochana, the illuminator. And Virochana is the great cosmic Buddha. So the great cosmic Buddha, Virochana, has this amazing tower. And Sudana gazes in astonishment at this edifice. It's made of light and jewels. It's infinite in extent. And for many, many dozens of pages, this is described. So I won't quote all of it. And the two of them stand in front of the door to this tower. And Maitreya has been watching Sudana's progress, and he wants to encourage him. And he says to him, "You're doing pretty well, mate. You are doing pretty well." And this is what he says. "Born of the dragon of the mind of enlightenment, ascended into the sky of reality, reigning the teaching everywhere, you, Sudana, foster all good fruits. You will light the lamp of truth, dispelling the darkness of defilement. The lamp is a strong vessel of love and of awareness, glowing with the pure flame of the spirit of enlightenment. From the embryo of the aspiration for enlightenment, compassion and love, gradually developing the limbs of enlightenment, this baby Buddha is growing." So that's what Maitreya says to encourage Sudana. Then, and I'm still reading this out, "Then Sudana respectfully circumambulated the Bodhisattva Maitreya and said, 'Please open the door of the tower. I want to see inside.' Then Maitreya went up to the door of the tower containing the adornments of Virochana and with his right hand snapped his fingers. And the door of the tower opened." Creaking noise here. Door opens. "And Maitreya bade Sudana to enter. Then Sudana, in the greatest wonder, went into the tower. As soon as he'd entered, the door shut. And he saw the tower, immensely vast and wide, hundreds of thousands of leagues wide, as measureless as the sky, as vast as space, adorned with countless attributes, countless canopies, banners, pennants, jewels, garlands of pearls and gems, moons and half-moons, multicoloured streamers." It's like Christmas, isn't it? "Jewel nets, gold nets, strings of jewels, jewels on golden threads, sweetly ringing bells, nets of chimes, flowers showering, celestial gardens, garlands and streamers, censers giving off fragrant perfumes, showers of gold dust, networks in the upper chambers, round windows, arches, turrets, mirrors, jewel figurines of women, jewel chips and pillars and clouds of precious cloths, jewel trees, jewel railings, jewel pathway, jewel awnings, various arrays of the floor, chambers of jewels, jewel promenades, rows of golden banana trees, statues made of all kinds of jewels, images of bodhisattvas, singing birds were there, jewel lotuses, lotus ponds, jewel stairways, ground of masses of various jewels, and so on. And he saw, inside the great tower, he saw hundreds of thousands of other Virochana towers, similarly arrayed. And he saw those towers as infinitely vast as space, evenly arrayed in all directions. Yet these towers were not mixed up with one another, being each mutually distinct, while appearing reflected in each and every object of all the other towers. So this is the great vision of interpenetration. You can probably see the symbolism of it, where this it became a form of Buddhism based on this, called Huayan Buddhism in China. And it just recognizes that everything reflects everything else. Everything influences everything else. And this is the symbolism of the tower. "Then Sudana, seeing this miraculous manifestation of the inconceivable realm of the great tower, containing the adornments of Virochana, was flooded with joy and bliss. His mind was cleared of all conceptions and freed of all obstructions. Stripped of all delusion, he became clear-sighted. He could hear all sounds with unimpeded mindfulness. He was freed from all scattering of attention, and his intellect followed the unobstructed eye of liberation. With physical tranquility, seeing all objects without hindrance, by the power of production, everywhere he bowed. In all directions, with his whole body. In the moment he bowed, by the power of Maitreya, Sudana perceived himself in all of those towers. And in all those towers he saw various diverse, inconceivable, miraculous scenes. In one tower, he saw where the Bodhisattva Maitreya first aspired to supreme perfect enlightenment, who his family was, what his basic goodness was, how he was inspired, how he was encouraged by his spiritual friends, how long he lived, what age he lived in, what Buddha he met, what land he adorned, what assembly he was in, what kind of special vows he undertook. He saw the length of life of those beings and of the Buddha of that time. He saw himself in the presence of that Buddha, and he saw all the works of that Buddha. And there's loads more of this. Then the Bodhisattva Maitreya, entering the tower and relaxing his magical force, snapped his fingers and said to Sudana, "Arise. This is the nature of things, characterized by non-duality. All things are characterized by non-fixity. They are stabilized by the knowledge of bodhisattvas. Thus, they are inherently unreal. They're like illusions. They're like dreams. They're like reflections." So I'll leave it there. I hope that gives you a feeling. In a way, the two stories, I hope, give you two contrasting aspects of the Mahayana. The very down-to-earth thing of wandering around a muddy road and helping somebody, on the one hand, but also this cosmic stuff that you get in the Mahayana sutras.